my fellow plebs. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Moon Mortgage. As the world moves increasingly towards the mainstream adoption of Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage makes it possible to materialize your assets into real estate. Through the collateralization of mortgages with Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage will be launching lending solutions to allow investors to easily leverage their assets to purchase investments in owner-occupied property. Moon Mortgage's crypto mortgage will be launching soon for home buyers in Texas, Florida, and Colorado, and will also be open to investors in most states across the U.S. for investment properties. Welcome to the future of mortgages. Visit moonmortgage.com today to register and learn more. Moon Mortgage Residential is registered with the NMLS under number 235334. My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. Today's episode is brought to you by Gordon Law Group. If you've tried to do Bitcoin taxes yourself, you know how complicated it is. You can spend hours and hours going through your transactions and researching tax forms, and you're still not sure if it's right or if the IRS will come after you. Or maybe you're so intimidated by Bitcoin taxes that you don't even know where to start. Gordon Law Group can help. Ditch the spreadsheets and feel confident with a bulletproof Bitcoin tax return. They can help with IRS payment plans, and they also provide a full range of legal and accounting services for Bitcoin and digital asset startups. Get your taxes done right the first time with the original Bitcoin and digital asset tax pros. Go to GordonLawLTD.com/BTC. As a bonus, they'll send you the ultimate Bitcoin tax guide for free. That's GordonLawLTD.com/BTC.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of FedWatch. My name is Ansel Lindner, and I am here with a special co-host, a returning special co-host, Nolan Bowerly. How are you doing today, Nolan?
Ansel, I love life. Who could complain? Things are going great. Looking forward to Miami. Looking forward to Bitcoin 2023. And it looks like the Bitcoin winter is over. I saw those ads, which we created for this past season. They were created before Christmas. You know, it seems like we need a new ad because Bitcoin winter is over, as we're going to see today,
Absolutely. And your winter exile is over.
Indeed. I have migrated with the birds, although my timing is somewhat off. It's kind of freezing today. I thought it could snow here in Montreal. I'm not kidding. It was close to snowing. I've been outside. It was 36 degrees. Pretty shocking to my system. But who cares? No one cares about the temperatures that I'm experiencing. They want to know what you have to say, Ansel.
Well, yeah, we have really big news this week. Of course, we had the FOMC meeting yesterday, and they announced their new policy, monetary policy. So we're going to go over that, go into kind of, are they causing the banking crisis? What's going on with the banking crisis? We've seen a bunch of banks failing recently. And then, of course, we got to touch on CBDCs because that is a big topic in the Bitcoin space. And so we're going to touch on maybe the IMF is having a shift in narrative on CBDCs. But I want to make sure to tell everybody, if you're here watching this, make sure you like, comment, and subscribe on YouTube or Rumble or wherever. We're trying to get this pushed out. FedWatch content is unique macro content in the Bitcoin space. So share in the bear.
Yeah.
But Nolan, do you have any other plugs?
I sure do, because that's two times you got me. Now, I was guest hosting around the Christmas run, and you saw a huge green candle, which you predicted. And I said, well, I think we're going to go straight. We're not going to fall anymore. And then it kind of cooled down for a little while. And on one of the last times I was with you before CK got back, I said the same. Oh, I think it's going to stay about the same. And now if I go back to the last time I was here, there's a huge green candle again. So there's been two big green candles in 2023, and you predicted both of them. So,
that, you know. Well, I've been directionally correct.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
So do you want to tell us about your morning shows that you do?
Indeed, yeah. So indeed, just like Ansel said, we love the likes. We love the subscribers. I have a show every morning, 8 a.m., called The Breakup, where we look at all kinds of reasons why you'd want to break up with the fiat clown world. It's a show about the other side of the trade, what we're dumping, right? Also, what we're building, we contrast it, right? So we talk a lot about nuclear energy. We talk a lot about Bitcoin and energy finance. The whole point of the show is that we're actually on the eve of a golden era. Some say an orange era, right? Coming down the pipe. So we're talking about what's ending and what's new.
So I put this on the outline, but it's at the end. Maybe we just want to cover this up front because it sounds like you've been talking about it. What are you thinking about the new Dame tax on Bitcoin mining in the US, the 30% tax?
You got to be bullish. You just have to be bullish. Right.
Why's that?
Well, we know that a Bitcoin miner in everyone's home is the future, right? Everyone being decentralized to that extent. So the more we are inundated and saturated with terrible ideas, the less confidence people are going to have in any of these people. So this is just another one of those reasons where you hear about the tax. You know, it'll probably never go through, or at least some states will counteract it. America has a beautiful form of federalism. I was just in Texas last week, and they don't mess with them about this thing. They're not biting, right? So I think it's great. You're really exposing the federal government for, in some sense, the obvious corruption, right? The obvious corruption. Mm-hmm. And so by seeing that very clearly, you're just inspiring more people in their own time to say, hey, maybe that might work. Maybe they might do something so stupid that there will be an opportunity for mining in every home, because there's no way to control that, right? You couldn't go to every home and figure a way out to tax all those people. So again, I think we thrive in contrast, and more bad ideas like this are opening people's eyes to what is possible. And that's really what it is. It's a race to beat the clown world, right? The only stress I ever have about Bitcoin is if we're ready for the main stage. Right, because it's coming quick. Mm-hmm. That's about it. And this is one of those examples. So I think it's a thing that would add resilience to the network. I would love for them to try this. I think it would just be, I'd light a cigar and sit back and watch and have a good laugh as everyone started mining at home and figuring out real decentralized energy grids as a result.
Yeah, I think your point there about are we ready for the big time? I like the response that people had, not only to this tax proposal, but to the hit piece from the New York Times with Pierre Richard. That the whole thing has happened since the last time.
Wasn't that the best?
But I do have a slide here. If Chris, if you could pull up slide number 12, please. This is, we're skipping to the end. And this is where they just replaced the word crypto mining with electric cars and charging. And it just points out the hypocrisy of the whole thing. So it's things like this too. Not only it could incentivize home mining, but it also points out this hypocrisy of all of their policies. So I think that it's a win-win for Bitcoin in a way. Any thoughts on this changing the
Well, the you know, here? It reminds me of something Ter Demeester used to do. Whenever we would go over these federal minute meetings and there was a press release, and it was especially in past years when it was about projections about when interest rates were going to be raised and when they were going to be, when quantitative easing was going to end. And he would always replace the language with methadone and heroin addict. And it read identical. It read identical. You know, the Fed Reserve is committed to quitting heroin in the next quarter. It will begin methadone treatments in Q2 and will proceed to be heroin free by Q3. So it reminds me of that. Somehow it reminds me of that. Whenever these things read straight and you switch out words, that's what it reminds me of.
Yep. All right, well, let's get into the Bitcoin chart, and we can ground our conversation in Bitcoin and its reaction to the FOMC meeting. So here is the daily chart. We are still above the 50-day moving average, just barely. We did close one day below it, but we are now back above. And there was actually a green candle yesterday after the FOMC meeting when the stock market was red. Bitcoin was still green. And if we do break out above this little red triangle formation I've drawn here, I think that's extremely bullish for the price. Again, holding that 50-day, that's seen. First off, let me explain the 50-day. So it is built into a lot of indicators, and it's built into a lot of trading systems. The 50-day moving average is a very important level. And so I really like to look at, that's kind of the 50-yard line. If you're above it, you're bullish. If you're below it, you're bearish. And so holding that 50-day is very important. And we still have a chance to break up here going into the conference in the next couple of weeks. If we go to the weekly chart on the next slide, you can see that I put that red zone in there again that we've been talking about for several months now. And we have been rejected from it, but really not forced back down too far. You know, we stayed quite a ways away from the last swing high, which was at 25,000. And yeah, it looks like green skies above the price. So Nolan, what have you been thinking about the price recently?
Yeah, I've started to really feel it. Like you said, I see the momentum there. I see a narrative building, especially around what you were describing a little bit earlier with people understanding a little bit more about energy literacy, you know, sort of the cause and or the action reaction to the White House statement that you were talking about. That's the other plus side. People are starting to become much more energy literate. So I can see the narrative around Bitcoin growing there, and I project that towards 2024. You also see a lot of momentum with all these challenger presidential candidates like RFK, who we're going to have at our show. And you see,
yes,
not just RFK Jr., Vivek Ramaswamy, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, all the challengers for the candidacy of president are talking about CBDCs and their danger and outlawing them and talking about the looming aspect of that kind of power. So you can see the narrative gathering storm, and you see it primed here in the price, right? The price is sort of a reflection of these narratives. And I just see it more than ever, right? I was in Texas last week. People aren't going to listen to no guff from Washington, D.C. about this stuff. So it's there. People were even talking in Texas. It was on the tip of people's tongues that because Texas has its own constitution, it has the ability to mint a redeemable for gold coin. It's allowed, yep, to issue its own money. And even that there's rumblings around that was sort of normal to hear. Now, I understand it's the niche of our industry, but people were talking about it literally. You get the people in DC and the New York City media talking about that $1 trillion coin. Oh my God, right? Well, what's more interesting is the Texans talking about a gold-backed settlement unit. So, you know, internationally with the BRICS thing being discussed, it seems like the storm is gathering around the old world. And it looks like indeed a lot of blue skies ahead, even in the price. So that's where I'm at. I'm feeling great. Feeling great.
That's a great point about all the different states coming out against CBDCs. Was it Montana or one of those Northwestern states came out banning CBDCs, just like Florida has now come out doing the same thing. So yeah, it's very interesting. And that goes right into our topic at the end of the show, which is the IMF could be also shifting their narrative on CBDCs. But let's go to the next slide. We have a few more charts here. I wanted to point out the difference between the Bitcoin chart and the S&P 500, since it has been so correlated over the last couple of years. And I saw a meme, you know, that the Grim Reaper meme where he's going down the doors and he's, you know, opening the doors and coming out. One of them was uncorrelated asset. Then it was stock to flow. And then the next one was a halving that he was about to knock on. And I mean, I think deep down, Bitcoin is an uncorrelated asset. And what we're seeing here over the last couple of days is Bitcoin maintaining its strength or going a little bit higher and the stock market reacting the opposite. So are we going to see some decoupling here with the stock market and Bitcoin? What does that mean exactly? But I am watching this 100% and I will definitely be reporting on it here on FedWatch. Any comments on stock market, Nolan, or should we keep going?
Yeah, no, I just want to, I continue to think this is absolutely the most important chart for Bitcoiners. This is indeed, I think, more important than price in a very real sense, because that correlation is what will indicate hyper-Bitcoinization. It will mean that Bitcoin is now more correlated with the commodity markets, for example. It's more aligned with the narrative around energy. You know, you can really see that there. So I think the narrative around energy is what can really pull these things apart. We're not there, right? It's always been most disruptive within Wall Street. Bitcoin's synonymous nature of being disruptive has been in relation to Wall Street and those folks. Mm-hmm. But now that you can see this energy narrative forming and crystallizing in people's minds, you see the opportunity for it to be totally uncorrelated. And that's what we all are waiting for. That to me is the most important sign. When this correlation is broken, you know Bitcoin is on its totally unique path and not related to, oh, how do the Wall Street people feel today, right? And that's important, right? That's important. We want their money too. Their money's, right? We want to incentivize their greed and get them on board, but the energy narrative gathering steam. So I see these things as really the most important chart that I pay attention to.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLive to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
One that I didn't include here that makes me think is gold. So, you know, Bitcoin will act like gold at certain periods and it'll act like a risk asset at other periods. So yeah, it can bounce between the two worlds, right? Being digital gold and being a risk asset. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. It's got something for everyone. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the next chart. That is the DXY. Of course, I follow this very, very closely. Chris, if you could remove our heads so people could see that real quick. Thank you. So yeah, we are bouncing on this bottom. It does not look very strong. And I hate to admit this because I am one of these, I'm not necessarily a dollar bull, but I'm not a dollar bear by any means. And this does look like it has a chance to break lower. We could also see a slight fake out lower followed by a dramatic rally. But yeah, right now the dollar is knocking on that door, looking like it's about to fall relative to other currencies. And if we go to the last chart here, we can just finish up the chart section of the show. And this is WTI US oil. I've been building this chart out. So you can see the rate or the production cuts back in October and then in April from OPEC. And then the bottom parallel channel there at the bottom starts at the date when the Biden administration promised to start repurchasing oil to fill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And that is the range at which they said they were going to be buying that oil to refill the SPR. Then in March and April, it broke down below that, right? You can see that. And that was obvious to OPEC that the U.S. was lying to us. The lie told by the Biden administration became clear. So they started making the moves to cut production by 1.6 million barrels per day. And that hasn't really mattered at all. The price of oil continues to drop. We now have a lower low. Just, I think it was today in today's trading, or it might've been overnight hours, but a new lower low. It just does not look good for the price of oil. And I'll point out here, if you guys have been watching FedWatch for any period of time, I've been bearish on the price of oil for 2 years. And everybody else is saying $200 a barrel oil, $300 a barrel oil. And it just keeps falling and looking weaker. So, Nolan, do you have any comments on the dollar or oil or commodities? You know, are you seeing anything different that you're watching? Floor is yours.
Yeah, I wanted, you know, when I was first asked to come today to fill in for CK, who, by the way, is over at MicroStrategy's event. In case people don't know, Michael Saylor has an event, all kinds of announcements. And of course, CK, as an important part of Bitcoin 2023, is doing some information gathering at other events. So when I was first asked to come here and do this, I immediately was curious about your take on dollar wrecking ball, because I saw that narrative in the autumn. I agree when that happened. when people were predicting that that dollar would have so much attractiveness in the autumn, Q3, Q4 last year. You had been a proponent of that a year ago, saying we're going to see this. By the way, for those who don't know, dollar wrecking ball is this theory that all these economies around the world are going to push a demand for U.S. dollars, and it would have a mopping up effect of all the liquidity being pushed into economies, and that it was going to find its way, for example, into U.S. markets and investments and protect, safe haven type situation. So, but of course, that was pre-BRICS 2.0 becoming more formalized. It was pre-Saudi Arabia's huge announcement about settling in renminbi with China, with the other part of the deal being that the Chinese have finally given the Saudis nuclear technology. So I was unaware that for years now, America has been negotiating and playing hardball with the Saudi government about sharing nuclear technology so as to not create a regional dynamic with the Iranians trying to get nuclear energy. Some people say, who knows, even putting the negotiations with the anti-nuclear efforts and the Iranian government above the needs of, supposed partner and friend Saudi Arabia. So what I mean to say is worries about negotiating peace with Iran took precedent over satisfying the energy demands and strategic long-term planning of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So that looks like what the deal was to me. China came in, signed a peace deal of their own between Saudi and Iran so as to not start a regional nuclear arms race, and then directly funded nuclear technology and directly shared nuclear engineering expertise with the Saudis. So when I see all of those things going on in the world, we saw Japan, of course, deciding to settle in other currencies. France famously has also said going to settle in other currencies. So I don't know the numbers. I don't understand. I hear a lot of people say, oh, this is just a drop in the bucket. The trade use of the dollar, forget about the reserve currency and just what countries keep the balance sheet in. The trade currency part of the US dollar was already pretty shared evenly with other countries. This is more the same. America did not dominate overall trade volumes the same way they dominate reserve on the balance sheet of central banks. So people making that comparison, again, I'm not familiar with the numbers. So when I see them stick out, I don't have a sense of proportion, how much different the demand is right now. But so here's the long story short, when I was asked to come on today, that's what I was most interested in asking you about. So do you have any updates to your overall agreement to dollar wrecking ball, and how has the last few months really played into your understanding of the dollar in the world and those kinds of things?
Well, when the dollar was strengthening last year, I drew some simple Fibonacci's on the chart and it came out to be about 112. And so once we hit 112 on the DXY last year, I was like, okay, well, we're going to have a sizable consolidation at this point. And I think that the dollar will still strengthen over the next couple of years, but I think the dollar wrecking ball is kind of over for now. And as for de-dollarization, I think we talked about this last week. It is one of the largest topics in macro right now, is people wondering about de-dollarization. Really, maybe you could talk a couple percentage points in the reserve currency status, going from, like, say, 61 to 59-ish percent of reserves are held in dollars. But the yuan really isn't getting any more of that. It's mainly going to the euro. So it's going back and forth between these two Western currencies that, really the U.S. backs up the euro as well, as we're seeing in Ukraine and all this stuff. So the euro is just a subsidiary of the dollar. And so if you take those two together, there really is no threat at all with these two currencies losing their dominant status. As for the Middle East and all this stuff, I think they're kind of scared right now of the U.S. not protecting them. And so they're kind of trying to look around and find some other allies that they can count on in the future, because the U.S., I think, whether you see it as a waning power or you see it as a withdrawing power, kind of like withdrawing from its hegemony role. That's more the way I view the U.S. right now. And I think the Middle East is looking to hedge their bets on some things. But also, global demand for oil and energy is tanking. You can look at natural gas, you can look at oil. All these things are going way down. And so I think Saudi is kind of scared. And you can see that in the production cuts. They continue to cut production.
That's the demand destruction our central bankers were so keen on.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Any more on a dollar? What was the term I used for it? I say it's the dollar derangement syndrome. Oh, no, sorry. De-dollarization derangement syndrome is what it is. So yeah, any more on that?
No, that's perfect. That's the answer I was looking for. I knew you'd have a nice tight one and you give me confidence to go in that direction as well. Cause that's sort of, you know, you hear a lot of the talk about de-dollarization. You got to put it in perspective. Sure, the bottom could fall out, but there's a lot of, there's not a lot of attractive alternatives right now for these folks. And
exactly.
Again, why I continue to think that the growth of Bitcoin directly into the energy sector is so attractive right now, because, you know, my worldview, seeing everything that's going on in American politics, the whole world is looking more and more like a Russian oligopolical economy. And if you get near the energy companies in that environment, you're doing great, right?
True. Or Wall Street.
Yeah.
If you could be Wall Street or energy. Yeah. Okay, let's get on to the main headline topic for today, and that is the FOMC meeting from yesterday. They did raise 25 basis points up from 4.75 to 5%, and they raised that range up to 5 to 5.25%. It felt more like they were less sure. A lot of people were commenting about Powell in the press conference. He seemed less sure of himself. So there was that. This slide here I found on Twitter, and it was from Lance Roberts. So you guys, I'll make sure to link it in the show notes when we put this out in podcast version. But it just highlights the differences. The main one between last FOMC meeting and this one is this red arrow here. So they added in determining the extent to which, and then they go on, additional policy firming may be appropriate. And they took out the committee anticipates that there will be further firming appropriate. So that's a big change. And a lot of people were talking about, oh, that means that they're not going to raise anymore. That they last meeting, they said, they anticipate that further firming will be appropriate. And now they're not saying that anymore. They continue that they want to go to 2% over time, but they took out that they want to attain a stance of monetary policy that is sufficiently restrictive. So they must already think that they've attained this if they took out that they need to go forward more and attain. So that was pretty much the breakdown of the language out of the FOMC statement. And now I have three clips. They're a little bit longer. I mean, I think they're 2.5 minutes a piece, but let's jump into those and I'll get your reaction following the first one. So producer Chris, we're ready.
Steve Leisman, CNBC. Can you tell us what the Federal Reserve Board did in the wake of that February presentation where you were informed that Silicon Valley Bank and other banks were experiencing interest rate risks? And can you tell me what supervisory actions you've done in the wake of the recent bank failures to make sure that banks are currently appropriately managing interest rate risk? And kind of part three, but it's all the same question here. Do you still think this separation principle that monetary policy and supervision can be handled with different tools? Thank you.
Sure. So the February 14th presentation, I didn't remember it very well, but now, of course, I've gone back and looked at it very carefully. I did remember it. And what it was a general presentation. It was an informational briefing of the whole board, the entire board. I think all members were there. And it was about interest rate risk in the banks and lots of data. And there was one page on Silicon Valley Bank, which talked about, you know, the amount of losses they, or mark-to-market losses they had in their portfolio. There was nothing in it about, that I recall anyway, about the risk of a bank run. So it was, I think the takeaway was they were going away to do an assessment, a horizontal assessment of banks. It wasn't presented as an urgent or alarming situation. It was presented as an informational, non-decisional kind of a thing. And I thought it was a good presentation. And as I said, did remember it. In terms of what we're doing, of course, I think banks themselves are many banks are now attending to liquidity and taking opportunity now, really since the events of early March, to build liquidity. And you asked about the separation principle. Like so many things, it's very useful, but you know, ultimately it has its limits. I mean, I think in this particular case, we have found that the monetary policy tools and the financial stability tools are not in conflict. They're working well together. We've used our financial stability tools to support banks through our lending facilities. And at the same time, we've been able to use our monetary policy tools to foster maximum employment and price stability.
But the staff report said SVB has significant interest rate risk. It said interest rate risk measurements failed at SVB, and it said banks with large unrealized losses face significant safety and soundness risk. Why was that not alarming?
Well, I mean, I didn't say it wasn't alarming. It was, they're pointing out something that they're working on and that they're on the case. I'm not sure whether they mentioned, I think they did actually, they mentioned that they had taken regulatory action matter or supervisory action in the form of matters requiring attention. So I think that was also in the presentation. I think it was to say, yes, this is a bank and there are many other banks that are experiencing these things and we're on the case.
All right. So you can tell what seemed a little bit less sure of himself, flustering, tripping over a bunch of his words. And yeah. So what was your takeaway from that, Nolan?
Exactly. That it's when your job is to project confidence, right? Because that's a big part of the job. And you hear the person tripping over their words. I mean, look, a lot of this stuff is really complicated. I'm not saying I understand how many regional banks the system can support against in what he was talking about, interest rate risk, right? Is there a right answer or not? These are the types of things that are 100% psychological. And we know bank runs, right, are of that nature. So, you know, I find it funny that you know, Janet Yellen, you know, Yellen fire in a crowded theater and Janet Yellen out there trying to stop a bank run or any of these things. It's kind of the right people at the right time if you're a Bitcoiner, in a sense, right? When you're thinking about the type of change that we have in mind, when you think about completely changing the world order of money and you hear these people telling what is obviously a lie. I mean, it's obvious, right? They were, you know, what I get out of that is someone who's trying to say, oh yeah, we saw one bank and it was a big deal. And I think we pretty much figured it out. And there's like people working on it and, you know, it's fine. Like, I know there was other stuff, but it's the same thing and we're doing something. So it's good. It's kind of a crazy thing to say. Now, I get what he's saying about the balance, right? I actually do give him a bit of credit for that. I never thought they would stick to their guns when the bank thing started and they were raising interest rates. So I actually got to give him some credit that when I doubted his mettle about staying on course for the policy, for interest rate hike policy to fight inflation, which has been the goal for over a year now, you got to give them credit for that, right? And the policies that they have enacted for the short term are probably the right ones in the sense that you're making sure depositors don't have that risk. You're nuking the bond owners, the people who own the banks. They're just having to bear the brunt of this. And now you're getting people strategizing. I saw Arthur Hayes's note from the desk of Arthur Hayes. He's betting on all these regional banks that have too much exposure to commercial real estate, for example. And he's going to start putting options on those, he said in his note. And it looks like there's a strategy out there for people who want to run through this hole. And they've made the target pretty big, right? The way they've done it, bondholders and those kinds of things. So the reverberations are there. I mean, this kind of, you know, whipping of the steering wheel as you go creates a lot of opportunity and volatility and certainly doesn't inspire too much confidence. So there you go.
Yeah, I think I thought it was really very interesting when he was saying, talking about so they went back and they reviewed everything that went wrong with Silicon Valley and Signature and stuff. And they said, okay, well, we noticed the duration risk, this interest rate risk. We noticed that, but we didn't foresee a bank run. And I'm like, you didn't foresee a bank run? Are you kidding me? But anyway, I still go back to thinking that Powell is a relatively honest broker here. And I don't feel like he's purposefully lying to people, because there's a lot of times in this press conference where he's like, we don't know. We just don't know. We don't know this. We don't know that. But we think our policy tools work this way. So I don't know. You said that he was lying and stuff. It's possible. He's obviously trying to manipulate the narrative to help guide the economy a certain way. But overall, I mean, he's much more honest than Janet Yellen was, or Ben Bernanke, that's for sure. So, okay, you ready? Got anything to add, or ready for the next clip?
No, you know, I will say from HBDC's comment, it is indeed a confusopoly. So I will take back what I said about lying, right?
Yeah.
But indeed, if you can speak in a manner that's hard to track, let's say, you can kind of hide responsibility in this case. Yeah. So I won't go out and say he's trying to deceive as so much as he's trying to not be pinned down. And that's fair enough, right?
You know, manipulate. He's trying to manipulate, yeah, for sure. All right, producer Chris, we're ready for the next one.
Tim Morales of the Wall Street Journal. Chair Powell, the argument around the end of last year and the beginning of this year to slow down the pace of increases was to give yourself time to study the effects of those moves. After the bank failures in March, as you've discussed, the Fed staff projected a recession starting later this year. So my question is why it was necessary to raise interest rates today, or put differently, if the whole point of slowing down the pace was to see the effects of your moves, and now you've, for the last two meetings, been seeing the effects of those moves, why did the committee feel it was necessary to keep moving?
Well, the reason is that we, again, with our monetary policy, we're trying to reach and then stay at for an extended period, a level of policy, a policy stance that's sufficiently restrictive to bring inflation down to 2% over time. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do with our tool. I think slowing down was the right move. I think it's enabled us to see more data, and it will continue to do so. So, We have to balance. We always have to balance the risk of not doing enough and not getting inflation under control against the risk of maybe slowing down economic activity too much. And we thought that this rate hike, along with the meaningful change in our policy statement, was the right way to balance that.
And just to follow up, you know, what you said in response to Howard's question, you'll need data to accumulate to determine if this is a sufficiently restrictive stance. Does that data need to accumulate, or could it accumulate over a longer period than a six-week intermeeting cycle?
I would just say that this assessment will be an ongoing one. You can't with economic data, you can't. You've seen, take inflation for me. Look back. We've seen inflation come down, move back up two or three times since March of 2021. We've seen inflation have a few months of coming down and then come right back up. So I think you're going to want to see that, you know, that a few months of data will persuade you that you've got this right, kind of thing. And, you know, we have the luxury. We've raised 500 basis points. I think that policy is tight. I think real rates are probably, that you can calculate them many different ways, but one way is to look at the nominal rate and then subtract a reasonable estimate of let's say 1 year inflation, which might be 3%. So you've got 2% real rates. That's meaningfully above what most people would, many people anyway, would assess as, you know, the neutral rate. So policy is tight, and you see that in interest sensitive activities, and you also begin to see it more and more in other activities. And if you put the credit tightening on top of that and the QT that's ongoing, I think you feel like, you know, we may not be far off, or you know, possibly even at that level.
Okay, so the question from Nick Timmeros, he is the new modern day Fed whisperer. People think that he might have some sort of inside track on the Board of Governors. But so he asked if the point was of slowing rate hikes, you know, they were doing 75, 75, then they did 50 and then 25. The reason to slow was so that they could wait for more data to come in and they could see what was the effect. Now they've started seeing the effect. So why keep raising rates? That I think that was a very interesting question there by Nick. In Powell's comments, he said the risk, this is what I picked out, the risk is there's more risk to underdoing it. So letting inflation continue, there's more risk there than overdoing it. Because you know what they can do? they can cut rates by 100 basis points in an emergency meeting, right? And that would help save any sort of crash that would happen. So they can cut very, very quickly. So he's saying that the risk is to not getting a hold of inflation, letting inflation run hot, and that they can always come back and cut. And that is going to be our next topic, by the way. But Nolan, any comments on that clip?
Yeah, the Nick Timonos Fed whisper theory seems to be like the setup for that revision that you led this segment off with, the part where it says in determining the extent to which additional policy firming may be appropriate that have been altered from the committee anticipates that some more tweaking is going to be needed. That exact distinction between the two different note releases that you compared at the beginning of the segment is exactly what looks like they set up there. That looks like an underhand pitch, and Powell did not seem as flustered by that question as others. And I think indeed he was easy to understand there.
Awesome. Okay, the next clip is about recession. Can we avoid recession? I wonder what Powell thinks. Producer Chris, we're ready.
Hi, Chair Powell. Matthew Bosler with Bloomberg News. So many analysts noted at the time of the March FOMC meeting that at least half of Fed officials' projections did imply or seemed to imply that a recession was in their baseline forecast as well, given the strong first quarter GDP tracking estimates. And so I'm just wondering if you could kind of elaborate on, you know, why you're optimistic that a recession can be avoided, given that that's the Fed staff's forecast, possibly also the broader committee's forecast as well, and also, of course, most private sector forecasters.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I know what's printed in the Summary of Economic Projections and all that. I don't think you can deduce exactly what you said about what participants think, because you don't know what they were thinking for first quarter GDP at that point. They could have been thinking about a fairly low number anyway. In any case, I'll just say I continue to think that it's possible that this time is really different. And the reason is there's just so much excess demand, really, in the labor market. It's interesting, as you know, we've raised rates by 5 percentage points in 14 months, and the unemployment rate is 3.5%, pretty much where it was, even lower than where it was when we started. So job openings are still very, very high. We see by surveys and much evidence that conditions are cooling gradually, but it really is different. You know, it wasn't supposed to be possible for job openings to decline by as much as they've declined without unemployment going up. Well, that's what we've seen. So there are no promises in this, but it just seems that to me that it's possible that we can continue to have a cooling in the labor market without having the big increases in unemployment that have gone with many, you know, prior episodes. Now, that would be against history. I fully appreciate that. That would be against the pattern. But I do think that the situation in the labor market with so much excess demand, yet wages have been moving down. Wage increases have been moving down. And that's a good sign, down to more sustainable levels. So I think it's still possible. I think the case of avoiding a recession is, in my view, more likely than that of having a recession. But it's not that the case of having a recession is, I don't rule that out either. It's possible that we will have what I hope would be a mild recession.
All right. So there he said it's possible, it's different this time. Are those famous last words, Nolan?
Well, the nature of the jobs, I think, is what he's not getting to. They're not like the same. The overall topography of the labor market has changed considerably from 3 years ago. And just look at the tech layoffs. I'm not out looking at every industry and what the needs are, but it seems to me that it's mostly service industry stuff that is occupying a lot of this. A lot of gig economy stuff. So I think he's putting a happy spin on things. Now there's unseen forces here, right? We've got this new AI thing that I follow very closely that I'm using personally. I make my thumbnails out of it every day for my videos, for example. I run all kinds of stuff through the chat version, just trying to, you know, model putting it as a system into my own productivity. But, you know, so far so good. Now, I don't see it as this miracle thing in the short term that's helping all kinds of industries, but certainly it's starting to be felt when you see these large layoffs at some companies. Like, I guess Microsoft had a large round of layoffs and some of these other tech companies. So anyway, all this to say, the economy is indeed different in the sense that the overall landscape for jobs, I think, has changed, but I don't have a lot of data on that. That's a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it on the show here about a lot of people getting two jobs that can affect the employment numbers, as well as multiple listings, and that the data collectors just aren't quite up to date on how many times a listing is duplicated. So job openings and job number of jobs versus employed people, that can be all different. He said, yeah, it's possible it's different this time. Now, his base case is that the U.S. can avoid recession altogether. That's Powell's base case. I thought that was very interesting, because most of the board members are saying that they expect a mild recession. So we'll see if Powell is correct. I've been saying on my show that I think it's about a 50% chance of a mild recession and a 25% chance of a hard recession. So that leaves a 25% chance of no recession. And by that, I mean no textbook recession, right? Mm-hmm. Of two quarters of negative GDP growth plus the unemployment rate or whatever, however they calculate it now. So we'll see with crashing GDP, but we also have crashing CPI. So when you look at real GDP, which is what they calculate the recessions by, will we end up with a negative real GDP? I don't know. Powell is saying that he thinks we can avoid a textbook recession. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And that's all the clips I have from Powell. So Nolan, any summarizing thoughts on Powell before we move on?
Yeah, you know, I thought, agreed, it's a manipulation exercise and an important one. You know, they've got to, we see how the market reacts and things like that. So I think he did his job effectively, other than a bit of the stuttering and stopping and going. And I'm with you on the sort of one half chance of a mild recession, and then the other half a split between not much versus a catastrophe.
Hard. Yeah.
Yeah. So that feels directionally right to me as well. I would say if I was forced to put a prediction on those things, it would look really similar. So with those as the conditions, I think his performance, and that's what we have to call it, this is a performance. I think the performance was, you know, if figure skating, you know, this is like a figure skating thing, or like a beauty pageant or something, you know, I'd give him like an A minus, you know. An A minus.
All right.
On performance, the substance, another story, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he came across, I think, as believable. But did the market believe him? That is the question. Chris, if we go to the next slide, let's skip 7 and go to 8, please. Jeff Schneider, who has been on the show before, he tweeted out this. He says, even the June SOFR futures. So, you know, there is no more LIBOR futures with the Eurodollar futures. Now it's SOFR futures. And they are pricing in that they might be cutting rates at the very next meeting. If you go to the next slide, Chris, it is this chart that Jeff Schneider put out as well. And you can see that June, so going into the meeting would be the gray line, basically, or the dashed gray line. And then Jeff is showing how it's moving downward. So even after the meeting where they raised rates, SOFR futures are pricing in a higher percent chance of a rate cut at the very next meeting. So I think this is very, very interesting. And this goes back to what we said during the second clip, where he said that the risk is more to let, you know, they can always cut rates. The risk is more of not raising rates enough. So I think this rate hike was exactly that. He's like, okay, we're going to do one more and see what happens. And they can always cut rates at the next meeting. That is all I have for the banking crisis. Let's go to the slide number 7. And that is the, you probably saw this floating around, Nolan, the bank failures from the Great Financial Crisis compared to today. And now we have some more with, what is it, PacWest and a couple other banks look like they're failing as we speak. So any thoughts on this? One thing I'll add, sorry, before I hand it over to you, is that I saw a tweet. I can't remember who put it out there now, but they said like in 2008, the entire banking system was insolvent. And it just happened to be these banks that went bust. So if you were to measure how many banks were bad in 2008, it would be all $20 trillion of deposits. But now it's just these three banks. So it's kind of mixing apples and oranges here a little bit. But Nolan, do you have any comments on this one?
Yeah, I'd say we got to keep waiting for the story to play out. As like, it's just today, it's in real time. So when they said that those banks were all insolvent in 2008, if you're paying attention to what Balaji Srinivasan is saying with the bet that he just settled this week, the BitSignal bet, of course, that he made about Bitcoin going to a million, but he admitted the truth that it was a persuasion technique trying to get everyone to talk about what he knew to be the truth, which was that the Federal Reserve supervisory system over the commercial banks have known this truth about the ubiquitous hole in most balance sheets because of interest rate risk. Interest rate risk was just rarely properly managed, according to Balaji's theory, right? Which checks out with me, but I haven't analyzed it to the extent that he has. And I didn't have $1 billion or $1 million on the line. So I'm pretty sure he checked it closely. So just this idea that the problem is probably more systemic than is indicated in this graph. Because again, any one of those small regional banks that didn't exercise really against the grain risk management, right? Because that's what it took to understand this. You had to manage interest rate risk for the first time in your career, maybe, right? This is not something any of the risk managers at any of these banks had ever really done before.
Yep.
What happened in the financial crisis was a completely different scenario. It was just simply bad trades, not understanding the exposure that folks had to the credit default swaps and the toxic assets that they had on their balance sheet. Much easier to understand, and you can see how it went throughout the system. And of course, you know, like Michael Lewis, right? We've got Michael Lewis coming to Bitcoin Miami. His whole theory in The Big Lie, if you read the book and not just the movie, it's that there were these handful of people that were able to see through the herd mentality around systemic risk that was happening in 2008. But this time, this looks like a trade that this muscle hadn't been exercised in a long time. This is like a vestigial limb or something. This is like a part of risk management that had been forgotten. The bread and butter of bank risk management, really interest rate risk, before the 30 years of low interest rates that America has come to think is normal. You know, they hadn't really managed that. So the 500 basis points, as Powell said, did cause whiplash in a lot of places. How many necks did it break? We don't know yet. We really don't. We don't know how many it broke, right? They're able to hide it doing the fractional reserve
bailouts and
Not even bailouts. No, just the follow the ball behind the cup fractional reserve. Oh. Yeah, you have enough money. You have enough money. You're great. We have it. We have it. We have it. Because had the system for the emergency backstops not been created by the Federal Reserve and Janet Yellen and all that stuff, and there'd have been a real bank run because depositors were not insured and they were worried about the follow the missing ball game, then it probably would have been much worse, right? I don't think that would have been capped. You know, we heard a lot about the era of social media and its capacity to inflame bank runs. There simply was nowhere near enough money in the system, right? As I understand, there's $30 trillion that are insured by the FDIC or something like that.
And 25, I think, or something.
Yeah, but there's nowhere near that in any of the, you know, so it's that's what they're managing against, and the bad trades that all of these banks thought were no-brainers, right? Because again, these folks are being punished for the thing that the safe thing they'd always done in their life was buying these T-bills and then, or the 30-year bond or the 20-year or the 10-year or whatever it is that they're buying that is supposed to be safe, is what caused this whiplash and created this situation just on their balance sheets. Now, we understand it isn't that they lost money. They lost, you know, they made a bad trade. They're in a bad position on their balance sheet. So that is what I see not represented yet in this graph. Like, we don't really know the extent of what's going on now, and it can take on a life of its own again, right? This is the zombie nature of what's going on. It reminds me a lot of an unkillable zombie, right? These banks that are, it's probably going to be a season. Like, we might see this every couple of weeks now, right? Another one catches, and then everyone talks about it, and within a week they're nuked.
There's 7,000 banks to go through, so yes, we got a long way to go. But yeah, I watched great comments there, and I watched a podcast with Cam Harvey. He's the guy who originally wrote the dissertation on interest rate curve inversions. And he wrote that back in 1986, but it's been back tested all the way, you know, into the 60s, that every time the yield curve inverts, there's never been a false signal either. It's always led to recession. But he was on a podcast and he was saying he thinks it's wrong this time. And I was so interested by that. And he said back in the Great Financial Crisis, this was only, if he wrote that paper in 86, then it maybe got some play in the dot-com era, but most money managers didn't know about yield curve inversions, believe it or not, when it came time for the Great Financial Crisis. And the yield curve inverted in 2007. So they should have known, right? And they should have become defensive, but they weren't. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then it crashes. But Cam Harvey said that this time, actually, people were seeing this yield curve inversion forever. And so they've been hedging, or they haven't hired those people, or they have done different investments with their businesses. And so he's saying that fact alone, that the yield curve now is so watched by everybody, that you would fire your wealth manager if he didn't look at the yield curve, right? And so he's saying that fact alone makes it so it can be priced in. And I thought that was a fascinating thing. When you look at the stock market for the last year or so, it's been sideways. Well, that's because people have been pricing this in. And back in 2007, if we would have had the same market, it would have been way higher by now. So if
what I'm saying, let me repeat what you said again, and just filter through what I said. So indeed, the idea of interest rate risk management is, people did see it coming, and that it might not be every bank this time, because there were some who were too short-sighted to understand it or use it. And those are the ones that are getting caught up right now in all this trouble with interest rate risk. But that nevertheless, the events of, and this is what, according to what this guy said on the podcast, people have systematically learned after 2007 how to manage interest rate risk. And it's not something that just hasn't been around for 30 years. They indeed have learned about it, but maybe just not widely enough. And that there's a few banks who made a mistake and it blew them up.
Yes. CFOs of Main Street have learned it. And people, you know, the main economy has learned about yield curve inversions, and they've properly prepared. The ones who haven't are these excessive banks.
Yeah. Okay. That would make sense to me again. Then I would refine what I said and say that makes sense, because indeed, you know, I didn't really know much about yield curve inversion until 2019, when the first instance of it happened again after the financial crisis. I believe that was the first time, right, in 2009.
The repo rumble.
And so I was, you know, covering that on the fake news. I would go on CNN and CNBC and Fox to talk about the implications for Bitcoiners. But indeed, it was a real story back then. So, yeah, I stand absolutely corrected on, and didn't know that tidbit, that had become sort of common knowledge. But I think what we are seeing still, though, is people who just didn't heed that warning and seem to have recklessly not understood interest rate risk was the actual business of a bank.
I think you're exactly right. Yeah, you're exactly right when it comes to the banking, regional banks, and like SVB, and First Republic, I mean, they were so irresponsible.
Yeah.
So I think you're right in that case, but I think it's interesting to add in that thing with the Main Street and the CFOs of companies and stuff, that they actually saw this coming. But we have one more story. I promised at the beginning that we'd get to this, and this is the CBDC story. We talked about CBDCs and the state governments kind of putting a kibosh on this. And now even the IMF is coming out and this is, what's her name? Kristalina Georgieva or something like that. She's the head of the IMF now. And she says, we don't quite know about the consequences of retail CBDCs. If you go to the next slide, Chris. So I'll just pull your attention to this underlined part here. What we are careful about is the choice between wholesale and retail CBDCs. We think that wholesale CBDCs can be put in place with fairly little space for undesirable surprises, whereas retail CBDCs, so retail CBDCs are those CBDCs that are, everybody has an account at the Federal Reserve. It is the bad kind of CBDC that we talk about the most. They completely transform the financial system in a way that we don't quite know what the consequences could bring. And then the next couple paragraphs down, she says that it would be a very significant transformation that comes from CBDCs. So they are changing their tune big time, I think. They are going away from the retail CBDCs and more towards wholesale CBDCs. Now, the wholesale CBDCs are just interbank transfers, right? It's very, very simple. But I'm getting a signal here that we have to wrap. So Nolan, I'll give you about 30 seconds for any comments on the CBDC stuff, and then let's wrap it up.
Yeah, what I see here is there is no commercial case really for a wholesale CBDC that I can understand, simply because is that not already what we have? I mean, do they not have some form of settlement at a level that only the commercial banks and the central banks
Fedwire.
So yeah. What are they talking about here? Right? Like what wholesale thing is out there that would need to replace what already exists? So as far as I understand, when you're talking about CBDCs, you're forced to talk about, because if we're talking about inventing something new and we don't know the consequences, we completely understand what's going on with wholesale CBDCs. Who cares what you call it? It's a settlement network for sophisticated counterparties. Has been around since time immemorial, right? That there's nothing different there. The case of this retail CBDC is, it's good that she's saying it out loud. That's what we want to hear, right? We want to hear this stuff said out loud. Then indeed, we don't understand the consequences. She doesn't seem to be selling it to the population. She's explaining this is serious business, and it does totally transform the reality of the relationship between the banking sector and the retail users. So as far as I can tell, we're over the target as Bitcoiners, right? Having these conversations is exactly what we want. And that the IMF is at least saying where the lines of division are, I think is great. So that's all I have to say. And indeed, we're going to be talking a lot about CBDCs at Bitcoin Miami, May 18th to 20th. It's just in 2 weeks. Can you believe it? I can't believe it's in 2 weeks. We've got candidates for the president of the United States coming.
Oh yeah, big announcement
about CBDCs for sure. We've got, I think you're going to have the most energy literate, financially literate gathering of human beings the world has ever seen. And that's what I'm looking forward to, right? Gathering with a bunch of people that understand that in many ways, the subjects that we hold dear to our hearts, Bitcoin and everything that's going on between the separation of money and state and new energy systems that need to be financed and built in a way that takes human actions into account, not just hopes and prayers and how Greta's feeling. And hopefully Greta likes what we did. And if she doesn't, we got to come up with a new idea. We're not going to be talking about Greta at the show. We're just going to be talking about how to build the future because we're so close to the golden age.
Paradigm shift.
There you go. And that's what our show is going to be all about in Miami. We're the only show with an optimistic vision of the future. And if you come, you're going to hear all about it.
All right. Well, Nolan, thanks for co-hosting for us today. Guys, thanks for listening. Like, share, subscribe, comment down below. Thank you very much for watching.
What is up, audio listeners? Thank you for enjoying another episode of FedWatch. Down in the show notes, you will find all the appropriate links to our social media, the original version of this podcast, and community links. Also, check out bitcoinandmarkets.com, where I put out a free weekly newsletter every Friday. And there you can also help support the show by signing up to become a paid member. See you next time.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLive to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.